Because it finally rained here in Carmel Valley for the first time since, I believe, January. So our valley was really parched, defying even the watering system in my garden. And it just feels like a perfect culmination of our, let's call it yajna, because that was what I was thinking, of our beautiful class together and our invocation of the goddess, that on this final day she manifested rain, which I hope will go on for a while, because boy do we need it. So why don't you take a posture, find a upright, comfortable, very focused posture, and as I often suggest, focus on the breath, letting the breath bring your sitting bones and hips and thighs into alignment with the seat, letting the exhalation draw your body upwards through the crown. And feel the breath making love to you. I know that several of you have described how this feeling of allowing goddess to enter you through the breath has been very powerful for you, and it is for me as well. So in a certain sense, if we could say that the only gift we received from studying goddess Lalita would be being open to recognizing how grace is constantly flowing towards us and through us with every breath, whether we think of the breath as originating from the air outside or from the activities of our lungs and diaphragm within, or even, as the tantras tell us, from the activity of goddess Lalita in union with her divine consort Shiva, sending down streams of erotic life energy in the form of breath from above. However we think of prana, however we think of that power that enlivens us through the breath, the truth is that we are always receiving it from goddess, who is not different from the self, but whom, for the sake of relationship, for the sake of worship, because we are beings who need relationship, we invoke her in this very beautiful form. So let's begin with our mantras, and then we'll meditate on the goddess in form. So let me just translate the dhyana shloka that we're going to chant. This is one of the great classical Lalita Tripura Sundari dhyana shlokas, and a dhyana shloka, as many of you know, is a verse that describes the way we meditate on a particular deity. So Lalita is described here this way. She is extremely entrancing, with a bow and arrows in her hands, and beautiful beyond measure. She is abundant with rosy radiance, compassion, and youthfulness. We praise the beauty of the Kula, which we translated as community or family, by which we mean the multitudinous diverse universe within which she manifests and within which she resides. And then finally, the next verse, which is a prayer, really. O goddess, you are the protector of the most secret of mystical secrets. Please accept the mantras I offer and grant me the attainment of self-realization. So, finding your posture, once again, we'll chant, and I'll chant slowly this time so that you can chant along. Let's bring our hands over the heart. In fact, we're going to meditate once we've completed our chanting. We're going to meditate in the heart. So you can bring your right hand over the center of your chest, your left hand over that. let the breath begin to bring your awareness into that space behind the breastbone. And we'll chant. Ati madura chapahastam aparimita modabana saubhagyam aruna matisaya karunam abhinavakula sundrim one day. Om guyati guya gotri tuam grahanas matkatam japam siddhir bhavatu me devi tvat prasadan maheshwari. Have the feeling that in response to your invocation, the goddess who is seated in the heart, who's taken a seat in your heart for this practice, is fully present, approving of your practice, and responding to the mantras, which we're going to really bring alive in ourselves through meditation. So bring your attention into the heart. Imagine the altar of the heart as a golden ground, a scintillating ground of light present in your heart center. And imagine Goddess Lalita seated on a red lotus in your heart. As you imagine the goddess in your heart, you might find that size becomes an issue. So you might imagine her in a miniature size that can fit into your heart. I find that when I do this practice, I will often experience her as seated in the heart, but extending upward over my body so that her yoni and her sacrum are in the heart. Her torso rises through the neck and head. Her upper body sways and undulates, and her head is perhaps 4 fist widths above mine. So in a certain sense, as I turn into the heart, as you turn into the heart, you might imagine Goddess Lalita rising out of your heart, seated in your heart, and perhaps have the simultaneous experience that she is both in you in the sense of being in your imagination and that you are also in her. And again, this doesn't have to be an exact visualization. But as I describe her and as you allow your imagination to dwell on her, you are actually bringing her presence forth. So Lalita is a beautiful bare-breasted woman, rosy red. Her skin is rosy red. Her hair is long and lustrous. She's wearing a crown. In the center of her forehead is her vertical third eye, which is wide open. Around her neck, along with some very beautiful golden ornaments, which you may visualize or not, also a necklace made of 52 skulls. And the skulls are an incredibly significant ornament of the goddess, because They represent the creative sounds, the vibrations that emanate from within her and which manifest as this entire cosmos. They also represent her power of dissolving egoic structures and allowing all of them to merge into her body, which is the body of the self, the body of the soul, the body of the transcendent state. So allowing the mind to ride the breath into the heart, begin to offer the mantra Om Aim Hrim Shrim Lalita Ambikaye Namaha with the inhalation. And with the exhalation, feel the presence of Goddess becoming stronger. The inhalation literally rides or carries the mantra into the heart. Om Aim Hrim Shrim Lalita Ambikaye Namaha. The exhalation allows the sense of Goddess's presence to expand through the whole region of your chest. Now with your next exhalation, feel as though Goddess, whether you're experiencing her in a visual, visible form or simply as a feeling, imagine the Goddess becoming a mist and flowing out through your left nostril. The whole presence that you've been invoking within your heart flows out through the left nostril. And the Goddess takes a form as an exterior presence seated in front of you. She's directly in front of you. Silently say her mantra, Om Aim Hrim Shrim Lalita Ambikaye Namaha. And as you inwardly pronounce the mantra syllables, feel that the Goddess Lalita places her hand on your head. Her hand is the hand of grace. And from her hand flowing through your topmost chakra and down through your body, you feel grace in the form of rosy energy flowing through your crown, filling your body, first your head and neck and shoulders. Feel that the hand of the Goddess shedding her red light into your body is filling you with softness, with health, and with joy. Continue to be present with this sense of Goddess seated in front of you, holding her grace-filled hand over your crown. And of her rosy red radiance flowing through your body, filling your brain, your face, your neck, flowing down your shoulders and back, releasing any tightness or tension that you may be holding there. Feel that rosy light flowing down your arms, flowing through your chest, filling your lungs, your belly, touching the organs in your abdomen. If you're able to be present to the felt sense of your stomach, your liver, your intestines, see if you can really experience the goddess activating health in your inner organs through this graceful light, and feel it flowing down through your hips, your genitals, your colon, your anus, down through your legs and your feet. Just sit with the sense of goddess blessing you, literally showering you with her rosy light. Be aware as you sit in this contemplation, be aware of how your inner body responds to this experience, to this visualization of goddess's light flowing as blessing through your body. Is there a sense of relaxation? Are you able to let go of your mind's doubts and judgments about how the process is working and whether or not it feels, quote, real to you? Can you feel how your cells respond . Now imagine that you breathe the form of the goddess back through your nostrils and into your heart. As you do this, it's very helpful to continue to feel the mantra flowing with the breath. And as you take the form of Goddess Lalita Tripura Sundari back into your heart, feel that she now occupies your entire body. Your head is her head. Her neck is your neck. Her torso is yours. Her whole body has become your body. Whether you're currently in a female body or in a male body, allow the goddess Lalita in form to occupy your form. You are, for this moment, the lustrous red goddess Lalita, And the more you can allow yourself to accept this, the more you might feel your pores quivering and shimmering with little pulsations of energy. Feel her pulsing in your body. Feel that she's breathing you. The rise and fall of the breath is the breathing of the goddess, who is nowhere else, although she's everywhere else. She's living in your body as you. As thoughts arise, whatever the thoughts, whether they're excited thoughts or doubting thoughts or just distracting thoughts, remember that the thoughts, too, are streams of the goddess's retinue. That is, the different yoginis who arise from within the heart of the goddess, who manifest this universe, begin within you by manifesting as streams of thoughts, as waves of breath, as energies flowing through your body. So your sense of her presence and your willingness to honor her as your body, as the power making thoughts arise, as the power of your breath, by offering the mantra into the body. This is the sadhana, the heart of the sadhana of embodying goddess. So you can open your eyes if you feel like it, and there's absolutely no necessity to open your eyes. We're going to be going in and out of meditation, and I would really love it if you would consider my words as part of your meditation. At certain points, you'll get intellectually engaged, or my voice will stop being meditative and kind of bring you up out of the deeper state you might be in. But also know that you can go right back. So this practice that we've just done is a classical tantric sadhana. And I have to tell you that if you were to do this meditation every day, that is, feeling the goddess present in your heart, on the altar of your heart, and then feeling that she comes out of your heart and takes a form in front of you and then blesses you and returns through the breath to take seat not only in your heart but as your body, you will eventually begin to experience Lalita as a very real presence both within you and also as the powers moving through you. And as you repeat this process, it actually stops being effortful and becomes natural. Some of you already are very aware of this, are very aware of a facility for embodying goddess that you have developed through practice. But what I also would like to say is that through this process of meditating on goddess inside you, outside you, and inside you again, you actually open yourself to deeper forms of Shaktipat, the literal descent of divine power from the heart of the universe, which paradoxically is also your heart. And another thing about this practice that I really love is that as you do it, it it actually starts to show you the power of your imagination, which is no small thing. Your imagination is goddess. She's manifested the world as an act of imagination. And she will start to show you, as you, if you are open, how you can use her power acting through your imagination creatively. And, of course, you could also use it destructively, but I think your intention in life, I would say that's true for all of you, is to use it for good, for the expansion of love. But if you don't know how to cultivate imagination as goddess and to acknowledge imagination as goddess, you actually are depriving yourself of what is probably the most powerful source of personal transformation that we have. You know, the great insight of the Shaktas, or one of the millions of great insights of the Shaktas, was that they're able to flow so easily with this, with the apparent paradox, with the paradox that the absolute is formless and ultimately unknowable by the mind and senses, and that this formless absolute can be invoked as forms, and the human body, your body, literally is the temple in which the worship and ritual is performed. And by body, I don't believe the tantricas meant the physical body, though it obviously does include the physical body, but actually the subtle body, the imaginative body, which is, of course, infinitely more creative and powerful than the physical body, even a very healthy physical body. So in traditional Lalita Tripura Sundari practice, there are actually very few external temples, more than there used to be. There is a couple in this country as well as in India, and I'm sure in other parts of the world. But even the external practice ritual is usually done in private spaces where the yantra will be drawn by the priests on a cloth that's laid on the ground, consecrated, and often only temporarily consecrated, you know, so that, in other words, we create the space for worship, whether inside our bodies or in an external space. And then we perform the practice. And then traditionally, there's part of the ceremony is that we offer our salutations to the goddess and ask her to depart. However, again, in my own experience with this kind of practice, there really is no reason why you should ask her to depart from your own inner body. Allow her to be present, cultivate her presence, and then notice what it does to the way you hold yourself, towards the way you live. Recognizing that Lalita is willing to be worshipped within you in many different ways, and that there also is actually nothing that you need to hide from her, which I think is one of the issues that we sometimes have about goddess presence. We think that some part of us is more acceptable than other parts of us, but, you know, the tantric goddesses accept it all. And even though Lalita is very much a goddess of auspiciousness and positivity, she's also the space within which every emotion and every activity manifests. And the thing is that even in very elaborate pujas, the person conducting the ceremony will always include her own body, his own body. It's usually a man conducting the ceremonies traditionally, or a couple. And so Tantra tells us, and this is not just blowing smoke, that the real purpose of the practice of tantric worship is to become the deity. You know, it's this sentence occurs in all the tantric texts: worship Shiva by becoming Shiva, worship Lalita by becoming Lalita, worship Lakshmi by becoming Lakshmi. And we can do these practices as psychological practices. So, in other words, if you want to become Shiva, what would you do? How would you act? I mean, obviously, to some extent, you would do a practice similar to the one we just did and install Shiva in your body, but how would you act if you were being Shiva? You'd probably be very precise in your yoga practice. You might spend a lot of time in meditation. You'd be spacious. You know, you'd be kind of more interested in the space around forms than the forms themselves. You would be loving in an unconditional yet detached way. You'd continually turn away from identifying with your physical body and instead probably cultivate awareness of your own awareness. So perhaps being Shiva comes down to cultivating awareness of awareness, cultivating the understanding that this one awareness that holds all this is yours. So how do you psychologically become Lalita? That is, how do you become the other aspect of the Absolute? So ask yourself that. For me, it starts with cultivating an inner feeling of beauty. And this is kind of challenging for me at this point in my life because my body is aging and I really, you know, I'm just as ageist as everybody else. So it's taken a lot of adjustment for me to be able to see my wrinkly body as the body of the goddess. But it's very powerful when you do it. And especially if you have had a problem with accepting your body as beautiful, to internalize Goddess Lalita is actually to start to appreciate how every pore and cell of your body is filled with her auspicious, exquisite qualities of basically gorgeousness. So, and that, by the way, is one reason why visualizing the goddess and taking her inside is powerful. Because in the end, we do begin to identify our beauty, our personal beauty, not with the transient and unevenly distributed, you know, symmetry of a youthful physical body, but with the beauty of being itself, which the goddess incarnates. And this kind of practice also helps you become much more comfortable in your physical body. And again, in my experience, it actually is very healing in all kinds of ways. I mean, physically healing. So we're going to be doing a couple more classical tantric meditations in this class. And before we do, I want to actually spend a fair amount of time in meditation and also to have some time for questions. So I just want to do a little bit of, I don't know what you call it, teaching, I guess you call it. Specifically as we begin with the principles behind Sri Chakra. One reason I took the time last week to describe the avaranas, the stages depicted in Sri Chakra, was not just to give you a visual aid, a kind of picture of the universe as a sacred display, which is, of course, what the Sri Chakra does. But also to give you the opportunity to play with the mantra as a meditation form and also as a source of truth, as really a symbol of truth. I apologize to those of you who weren't in the mood to take in the details about the triangles and the goddesses. And I also want you to know, as I think several of you figured out already, that in doing Sri Chakra practice, it's perfectly fine to use the yantra as a cognitive focusing device in which you, you know, you use the form as an external object of concentration, as Patanjali advises in the Yoga Sutras. And the way you do that is to focus on the bindu, on the point in the center, and just let the yantra pulsate and collect your awareness, collect your concentration. Another way to do it, as Willie wrote in one of the notes on the listserv, is to actually, you know, we have on the website, on the course website, a drawing of the different array of triangles on the body and you can use that as a way of meditating on these triangles in the different chakras. The way I do this is by actually imagining the Sri Chakra in its Meru form, which is a mountain. And it's the mountain that's said to be the world mountain, the central pillar of the worlds. It's a tremendously important symbolic form that represents the Sushumna Nadi and and you know, it creates a sort of mountain of presence that we can tune into. So you could imagine yourself inside the pyramid of the yantra with the central triangle either above your crown or in the third eye, and the other arrangements of triangles in different chakras. So there are different ways to practice visually with Sri Chakra that don't involve the entire ritual, which is time-consuming and which demands initiation. But my main personal takeaway from the contemplation that I have done on the Sri Chakra, on the Sri Yantra, and my understanding of why this practice is important is because, as symbols do, it will kind of cement in your unconscious this image of the universe as being the play of subtle forces which work together and which are personal. And I think that that's actually one of the most beautiful parts of tantric practice. It's when we realize that this world is not an impersonal arrangement of atoms and molecules, even though on a physical level it certainly shows up that way, but actually is the result of, first of all, the imaginative sankalpa of goddess, of a profoundly empowering sacred being, and that everything that is happening in it is actually being orchestrated by her and her retinue. So, and I would also say that maybe one of these days you'll find yourself in a Shakti temple, in a Lalita Trisundari temple, or a temple to Rajeshwari, who is one of her names, and recognize the forms in the temple as representations of the yoginis who are actually orchestrating your experience in it invisibly from within. So I'd like to just share with you three of the truths that Sri Chakra embodies, shows us. I mean, first of all, the thing that's, I think, very significant about the way that Shakta Tantrikas view the world is that, you know, the Sri Chakra shows us that this world arises out of bliss in a very graphic and powerful way, and in the process, carries the teaching that God is not an old judgmental guy with a beard, but a beautiful naked couple enjoying each other's existence and spreading their enjoyment everywhere. And I think this in itself is enough to transform your attitude towards religion. As you know, the Taittiriya Upanishad has a very famous teaching. This world is born in bliss. It is sustained by bliss. And in the end, it merges back into bliss. The Shivashakta Tantras declare the exact nature of this bliss. It's the bliss of cosmic sexual union. Shiva and Shakti represent awareness and energy, light and the capacity to experience light, pure being and pure ecstatic enjoyment of one's own being. So even though we may not necessarily be experiencing a goddess and her consort making love in the Sahasrara above the crown, when we meditate with this image, something is aroused. Over time, this center opens, and again, you can practice with this awareness, and you can begin to experience, especially as Kundalini Shakti plays through your Sushumna Nadi, you can begin to experience that there are streams of bliss that flow down from this center and that are constantly flowing. You just have to have the desire to become aware of them, because your desire expressed devotionally as a request of the goddess will eventually give you that experience, I can tell you from my own practice. So for most of us, this mythic image of the two lovers creating this universe through their act of delicious sexual engagement has many implications about what our natural state really is. You know, for Buddhism, at least traditional Buddhism, Hinayana and Mahayana Buddhism, says there is suffering, and it's your job to find the path out of suffering. And by the way, the problem, the reason you suffer is because of desire. We'll go into that later. Tantra says there is bliss, and your job is to choose that bliss and then practice technologies and thought structures that let you hold that recognition so that desire is no longer a source of suffering, but actually a source of liberation. So when you consider that the manifest world arises through the bliss of the divine couple, that God and Goddess are literally the primal parents of the world, as Yaneshwar Maharaj says, and that their lovemaking is going on inside your body, well, what would your natural state be except bliss? Despite the fact that we may not always be aware of it, what Tantra says is that it is happening. So the second teaching of the Sri Yantra and of Tantra as a whole is that the Yantra depicts the truth that the sacred source of the universe is contained in every part of it. In other words, the Sri Yantra is a picture of the holographic nature of the universe, in which every part contains the powers of the central aspect of it. So this fact that not only is reality born out of intimate relationship, but it's mirrored in all of our experience, is really quite a radical shift from our more conventional religious understanding, which most of us aren't even aware that we hold. You know, Vedanta and Buddhism, which are also non-dual philosophies and very powerful and transformative philosophies, moreover, teach that this world is simply a temporary appearance, and that the only thing that is really real is the consciousness that is experiencing it. So your Vedanta, especially contemporary direct path, Ramana Maharshi style Vedanta, it constantly encourages you to become aware of your awareness. and approach your life with that recognition. And think of your experience in the world as something that is unreal because it's temporary, because everything that you're experiencing is eventually going to come to an end. And what Vedanta and Buddhism say is that it's basically that there's no point, there's nothing worthwhile to be gained by getting involved in the activities of the spirit, physical world, except to the degree that the world supports our spiritual practice. And the obvious corollary to this, you all know this, is that that kind of spirituality is basically for people who don't have any worldly responsibilities. So Tantra agrees with non-dual philosophy, with the more renunciant-oriented non-dual philosophy, is that the world is arising and subsiding in consciousness and that we are deluded by its appearances. But in the Shakta tradition, our delusion is caused by really three things. First, our failure to recognize the sacred nature of the reality we see around us. And two, our failure to realize that the consciousness that's manifesting this world is our own consciousness. And the third thing that keeps us from self-recognition is that we have somehow not been able to coax Goddess into showing us her presence. And that, by the way, is why we do all these practices. Not to make something happen, but to really seduce or worship or adore Goddess sufficiently that she will open up for us, that she will she'll open her kimono, as it were. And that's, you know, that's not an idle metaphor, because the Goddess's kimono is the cloaks that she puts over her blazing radiance to keep us from seeing what we are. So the part of the problem that we can address through text, through teaching, is to start to see how our own processes of perception, our own mental creations, our own energies, and the world we experience are actually divine powers who have not only manifested as each one of us and as all of us, but which are constantly engaged in the creation, maintenance, and destruction of universes for the sake of what amounts to an outrageously huge art project. In other words, Lalita Tripura Sundari is an artist. She's a dancer. And this metaphor of the universe as a work of art is utterly fundamental to this system. And the idea here is that if we could just free up our belief structures, we'd be able to participate in the radical enjoyment of it. We would even be able to digest and assimilate the difficult parts. So the third truth that Goddess reveals through the yantra is that this universe manifests from inside out. And of course, there are the two great metaphors of the Indian tradition is the metaphor of the seed that contains the embryonic form of the tree, like the acorn contains the oak. You know, this is almost a cliche image, but it is really kind of extraordinary if you think about it, how inside this tiny little bindu that has nothing inside it, this oak tree manifests, this universe manifests. The other one I like this even better, is the idea that Goddess brings the universe outside of herself the way a spider spins her web and then dwells in it. And the other metaphor that the Tantras give us about how Goddess works is the image of the heart, the great pulsing heart, which can be found in the chest, but also can be found and is often described as being in the Sahasrara. And, you know, since everything is inside everything else, the fact that the heart can be experienced in the chest or experienced in the Sahasrara is actually no big deal for the goddess. But if you remember that this manifest cosmos is described as triadic, it emerges from the threefold powers of will, knowledge, and action pulsing through reality. And again, I'm going to say this in a very short way because many of you are extremely familiar with this, but the condensation of the infinitely subtle imagination of goddess into thought forms, which is basically how the tantras understand reality, this condensation takes place in stages, which manifest as various layers or folds of reality known as tattvas. And those of you who study with me regularly, you'll know that we went through this in our class on the Pratibhigna Hridayam, the doctrine of recognition, last January. And when you're in a particular tattva, the word tattva means thatness. It's an all-encompassing experience. So now we're in earth tattva, which is the densest and most diverse, complex layer of reality, where everything, including ourselves, seems extremely physical. But if we realize that even what feels very gross and concrete is actually manifesting from this subtle center, it means that nothing is as it seems, and Sri Chakra is actually a picture of what it really looks like, what the world as a succession of tattvas really looks like. So in tantric sadhana, which is essentially all about cracking the code of manifestation, of realizing what the physical world really is, so that you as an individual can use this world and your own body as a ladder or as a breadcrumb trail that can take you into the realization of what you are. That in itself, you know, that recognition itself is the basis of all the practices that we're working with here, and essentially all the practices that those of you who practice in a tantric way have learned and practice, not just from me, but from the other tantric teachers that you may have worked with. So one of the things that I love about studying tantra is that it also helps us recognize that systems theory and chaos theory and complexity theory and the other contemporary scientific ways of explaining the universe as a self-organizing ecological system, tantra actually is saying the same thing. And I think that's one of the reasons why it feels so modern to us and why it feels so kind of charged with truth to us. That, you know, part of the genius of tantra was to recognize this. And the thing that science is beginning to realize and is what the tantricas reveal to us, that the underlying energies that are organizing the world are sentient, responsive, and flexible. So, you know, if you've done shamanic practice, you have an actual experience of the fact that the natural world is actually responsive to your intentions and to your willingness to be present. To be with a tree and feel the soul of the tree. I have a friend who does these kind of amazing rock stacks in which he stacks gigantic, you know, rocks that weigh almost a ton. He stacks them on top of each other, and because of his ability to tune into the energy within the rocks, they stand on each other, they balance. I mean, you literally see these constructors, these structures with four giant rocks balanced on top of each other, and they stand, they stay. Although, of course, when he exhibits them, he has to connect them, otherwise it would be dangerous. But this is, you know, when we understand the soul in the physical world, it's not just that we manipulate the physical world, which most of us don't necessarily need to do. But it helps us understand that everything about our experience is subject to negotiation. You know, in the doctrine of recognition, one of the very deep teachings is that your process of perception is actually enacting the process of creation, sustenance, and dissolution that is going on the cosmic level. And it then goes on to say that when we don't understand that we are creating the world as Shiva Shakti, then we are at the effect of the world. We are actually run by the algorithm of the world, which is expressed in the Sri Chakra by the triangles and the goddesses. So if you ask yourself, what is making my experience happen? What you normally think is that it's, you know, your nervous system, it's your mind, it's your thoughts, it's, you know, the imbalances in your chakras, it's the problems in your organs, you know, that it has to do with your own interactions with the physical world. Well, what the tantras say is that actually no, that what you think of as your personal and personally created experience is actually the result of the algorithm, so to speak. I'm using that word, which is, you know, it's just a convenient word that helps us in contemporary computer language, helps us see that that we're actually not in charge as individuals. So how does the recognition that an array of subtle powers, yoginis, goddesses, are orchestrating your experience? How does this recognition change the way you see your experience at this moment? Suppose that rather than seeing this room as outside you, what if you were able to actually experience your body and the room as a kind of swirling emanation of shaktis that are appearing as the walls, as in my case the desk, as the computer, and as the people who have experienced the innovative, creative download that allows us to create computers and software programs. I mean, this is a difficult idea to hold. It's actually designed, I believe, to blow your concepts about how reality operates. And we don't really need to figure out how it all works, although the tantric texts are full of actually quite compelling lists of the ways everything comes down. But the point is that as long as we don't realize that the forces that operate through our mind and senses and our physical body are powers, and that these powers are our own powers. That, in other words, we have the we are manifesting our experience from within ourselves. As long as we don't recognize that, as long as we don't recognize the divine quality of the forces that orchestrate our experience, we are basically bound by those powers. So we're stuck in the picture that they present us. And the Recognition Sutras, in other words, and much of Indian philosophy, actually, tell us that the cause of our suffering is fundamentally our failure to recognize that the powers that flow through our minds and senses are sacred and that they're ours. Of course, the problem here is that we think of our own powers as being our limited abilities that we can currently command. We think that my powers means, you know, me, Sally's particular creative gifts or whatever, or, you know, the strength that allows me to lift a 10-pound weight but is not enough to lift a 40-pound weight. When we don't recognize them, they bind us. When we do recognize them, these same powers liberate us. And honestly, this is the whole point of tantric practice, is to, first of all, understand what it is that's creating our experience, and secondly, to cleanse the doors of our perceptions, to make our mind transparent enough to see what's happening, and to realize eventually that every experience contains a doorway into the realization of our absolute identity with consciousness and with Goddess. So find yourself a posture that is upright and comfortable. And internalize your attention so that you're using the breath, which is always giving us the gift of a pathway that can let us turn inside. We're going to do what I actually regard as one of the most esoteric and most powerful practices in the tantric tradition. It's a practice from Krama Tantricism, from the Kaula Tantricism also. And it's the practice of recognizing our senses as yoginis offering experience into the divine couple in the heart. So we're going to do it today as a kind of thought experiment. And I'm going to ask you at the end of this meditation what it was like for you. So your eyes are closed. Your hands are over your heart. One of the images that is very beautiful is to think of the heart as being like a beehive. And to imagine your senses, which, again, are the expressions of a group of yoginis, a group of goddesses, known as the sense goddesses. They're like the bees that flow out from the heart, contact the objects of senses, and bring them back to the heart for the enjoyment of the divine couple of Kameshwari and Kameshwara, who are in love with each other, enjoying each other. So before you open your eyes are closed, just start by allowing yourself to feel the sensation of all the ways in which your body, your skin is being touched. Feel that the sensations of the clothes against your skin and the air against your face are pleasurable. And if there's sensations that don't feel pleasurable, it's totally fine to include them. Feel that the sensations of touch that you experience are like flowers that you offer into the heart. So, as it were, interiorize your sense of touch so that that experience of contact, the contact between what you call your skin and what you call the air, which is a sensual contact, that this is an offering to God and Goddess in the heart. So let yourself fully feel the pleasure of sensation and consider it a gift that you're offering to the divine couple in the heart, and that your ability to enjoy the sensation of touch has been given to you for the sake of pleasing the divine essence that is you, and that is Kameshwari and her consort Kameshwara. So whatever it is that you're experiencing as touch is for divine enjoyment. And you can do the same thing with sounds. As you listen to my voice, or to the other sounds around you, focus on the experience of hearing sound. I hope that the experience of my voice is pleasing, but it works even if it's not. And offer the experience of listening, even the experience of making sense out of what I'm saying. Offer that into the heart. Are you aware of fragrance? Can you smell fragrance in the room? If so, offer that into the heart. And as you do this, as you, again, with your eyes closed, because it's very much easier to interiorize your senses when your eyes are closed, recognize that there is a kind of reciprocity, and this is the esoteric center of this practice, that you as an individual are an expression of the activities of the sense goddesses, this group of goddesses who are in charge of giving you the capacity to experience touch, taste, smell, sight, and sound. And they're giving you this experience for the sake of allowing the goddess and her lover to enjoy this diverse world through you. And as they receive it, they pour blessings back so that the blessings of God and Goddess in your heart are infusing your sense of touch, infusing your sense of taste, infusing your experience of sounds. Just see what happens as you feel into the sensations in your body and make offerings and then receive the blessing of the goddess who is enjoying your offering. And now I'm going to ask you to very softly open your eyes and see if you can do this practice with what you see. So the forms that you see around you, which I know will naturally take your attention outward, have the intention to look at what you see as offerings that are being poured into your heart by the powers of sight that operate through your senses. And feel that the love of Goddess and God, Kameshwari and Kameshwara, pouring out from your heart is infusing your vision, your eyes, and also the world around you. So if your eyes are closed, I invite you to open them. And I want to ask you to tell us a little bit about what you experienced doing this extremely esoteric practice. This is not an easy practice, I know. But it's pretty transformative, even if you don't feel like you totally got it. So I'm gonna ask you to raise your hand. And the way you do that is by pressing star 2. And once you have, Deb will recognize you and call on you. And so the invitation is to share your experience of the practices that we've done today, especially the practice of looking at your sensory experience as the activity of the goddesses of sense, and of offering your sensory experience to the heart. And it's also okay to ask questions. So, who would like to go first? Press star 2 to raise your hand.
Hi. Okay, we've got someone in Oakland. think it's Patricia.
Okay.
Yes. Hi, Patricia. Hi, Sally. Just this streaming of soft bliss, and I'm in a fairly dark room, but I see the reflection of myself in the window, and just thinking of that as goddess and energy. So it's I'm a kinesthetic. I lead with kinesthetic feelings, and it's so full of that bliss that you spoke of as the fundamental nature of reality. So what a blessing. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for sharing it with us. So is there anyone else who'd like to share your experience or ask a question?
Somebody in Oregon.
Okay, hi.
Hi, Sally. It's Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
Hi. Well, I just was really taken back to the heart of recognition with all that you were saying, and wish you would do it again someday. But it just felt like being held in the bubble, you know, and just all that stuff we talked about that you had taught us about before, about how we're just the vehicle through which the goddess experiences herself. And I've been experiencing this whole time in grief, in very deep grief, as you know, and it's been really very tender, actually, calling her into this incredible loss I'm experiencing. And so my question is, because at the very first class you talked about how you can get powers from this goddess, you know, how she can award you, not for the sake of the powers, but that, you know, she can award you this just different kinds of strength, you know. And so I feel like I've been sort of praying to her in this deep, open-hearted, like where my heart is just cracked open, and praying for access to the beyond.
Yeah.
So I and there's these moments where I feel like these voices come to me, you know, but I don't know if you know anything about that.
Well, I think
so
that
I don't know if this is the right place to ask you, but I've been wanting to ask you this all along. So, I mean, it's not like bliss that I'm experiencing these days, but it's this, like this ocean of love in grief, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, and I think that for someone whose consciousness is really open, which yours is, that the configuration of love and grief, which ordinarily we think are opposites, love becomes very accessible in grief, and it's one of the secrets of all emotions, of all especially strong emotions, as you know, because it's in the Vijnana Bhairava. That's what they're talking about. They're talking about how you feel very strongly that inside the feeling itself is a direct path to, really, to the
goddess.
Love that's, yeah, to the goddess. So I'm so glad that your practice has given you this capacity, and that you can identify it. You know, that you're not that you're able to see it. And yes, if you want to talk about it in detail, we probably should do it in another context. But thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah.
I
don't want to be disruptive, but if you could at some point speak about this idea of how this deep love empowers you, or that you can pray for certain kinds of, like, seeing or clairvoyance or, you know, speaking to the beyond or anything like that, because I think that's what you talked about in the first class. So
I did. I did. Well, I talked about it yesterday. I mean, last week. Yeah. So yes, I'm. Let me say something about it now. Because this universe and your own being is actually a playground of powers. You know, I said earlier about how reality is responsive, and how at a deeper level, reality is arising inside the imagination of the goddess, which you can and will eventually experience, if only as moments, as being your consciousness. So for that reason, you can pray or do positive affirmations for particular gifts or strengths that you would like to unfold. And at some point, they become accessible to you. So it's, you know, this is how the power of prayer works. It's not, you know, just something we do in order to make ourselves feel better. It actually works. So, and the Sri Chakra, which paints this picture of the universe as the play of all of these yoginis, all of these goddesses, when the chakra talks about the powers that are unfold when we do the Sri Chakra practice, they're actually talking about, let's call them attainments or siddhis, that are the result of our of a particular series of ritual practices. And what we're doing, you know, people like you and people like me and most of us here, we're not doing ritual practice. We're simply doing our very best to connect with our own heart and with our own imagination, and to accept the truth that, you know, that we do have access to the gifts that we think have to come from outside, that they are actually present inside us, and that through prayer, through tuning into our own imaginative capacities, we can cultivate these and bring them forth. So this understanding is really at the basis of a lot of the practices, like you know, a lot of the new thought practices, manifestation practices that are so popular these days, and their techniques and technologies that allow us to do this, the rationale for them, or the, you know, let's say the scriptural basis for the fact that we can transform reality, manifest, you know, better realities through prayer and affirmation and work. I mean, you know, nobody says that most of us can manifest circumstances just by wishing for them or just by imagining them. We also have, of course, we have to exercise our power of action to bring them about. But this is all possible. I mean, anything can be done through the power of the goddesses if we are sufficiently focused and, you know how to employ our mind, our heart, our skills, our activities, our knowledge. And yes, there are protocols for doing this, but it's also true, and I think it's a very important thing to recognize, that these capacities really function best for us when we're not using them for our own egoic satisfaction. And there's a very subtle thing here, because Tantra does promise satisfaction, and we all deserve satisfaction. So, but and it also points out to us that all of the everything that we create and everything that we wish for also carries consequences, and that that the consequences will either take us more powerfully towards the truth of the self or take us away from the truth of the self. And asking for things from the universe is a slippery slope. It's a razor's edge path. And it just needs to be done with a lot of care and a lot of consciousness. And as part of a practice in which you are constantly offering your experience and your desires back to her, back to the goddess in the heart. And I say this, you know, it's of course the great practice of the Bhagavad Gita, that the way you work with your desires, your ambitions, your fears, et cetera, skillfully as a normal person, as a well-meaning, well-thinking individual, the practice that all of us can do, any of us can do any time, is to offer it. So in a certain sense, if there are certain abilities that you want to cultivate, cultivate them with the understanding that you want to use them for the greater good, not simply for your personal satisfaction. Your personal satisfaction is part of the greater good, but that recognition, which I know you know very well, is part of what allows everything about your life to become an avenue to realization of the self. One of the things that one of my teachers used to say is that when we use the powers of consciousness for personal gain, these are the acts of sorcerers and magicians. And, you know, I think we are all interested in sorcerers and magicians and wizards, etc. But the tantricas say that when we practice sorcery, even if it's for good, we are creating karmic threads that will return to us in the future, either positively or negatively. So I find that there are certain circumstances in which I will choose to pray for help or practice manifestation, but I always try to be very sure that it's for the sake of service, and I always surrender it, you know. So that's what I would say in answer to your question at this point. It's certainly a topic that's worth talking about at greater length, and maybe we'll figure out, we'll do a course on it or do a session on it, on how a tantrika does manifestation in a way that is for the sake of liberation, rather than creating further further bondage. So thank you, Wendy.
Yeah, thank you, Sally. I really love you. I'm so grateful for you in my life.
We love you too. Yes. So we'll take one more sharing or question if anyone has one. And if not, this is kind of a going-going-gone moment. If not, we'll return to the practice. So I'm very interested to know how that meditation that we just did went. And maybe if you don't feel like talking about it now, you'll write into the listserv at some point. So what I just, you know, what Wendy and I just talked about, is a very important part of Tantra, because when you realize that your life is being woven from inside and outside by subtle energies, which you can invoke and influence, it also begins to empower you not to feel like such a victim of life. And it also primes you for what I feel is the great tantric experiment of tracing your desires and your sensory experience back to the self. And many of you do this practice regularly, or do these kind of practices regularly. Lauren Roach in the Radiant Sutras, which you know many of you have read and practiced with, has a whole series of poems which are based on the teachings of the Vijnanabhairava, although the Radiant Sutras, Lauren's work is not a translation, it's really more of a riff. But you know, one of the insights that contemporary tantricas have discovered, and you know, like Lauren written about or taught about, is how ecstatic it is to use an experience, a very mundane experience involving your body or your mind, to turn you back to awareness or to trace yourself back to the bliss of the goddess. And I want to share an experience that I've been having in the last couple of days. It's an example of how this works, and it can be the same thing can be done with a craving or a feeling of resistance, or obviously a smell or a taste or a sound. Where you trace the external experience or the mundane experience, let's say, or the mental experience, you feel into it and then trace it back to the Shakti that's making it happen. So this is my story. I have an injury in my coccyx, which will often pull the ligaments out of whack, so that means it's hard to sit and it's quite uncomfortable and actually it inspires all sorts of irritability in me when I'm not being conscious. So I was at the computer yesterday, and it's hurting, and I was getting more and more irritable. So I turned into it. I focused into the pain as sensation, and began exploring the sensations in the area without naming them as pain. This is one of the practices that is used in mindfulness, pain meditation, but it's also a tantric practice. So I was feeling around and feeling the discomfort here and avoiding naming it as pain. And then it occurred to me to think of the pain as a manifestation of the yoginis, of the goddesses, that in other words, to feel that, okay, there's a particular set of goddesses, perhaps, the goddesses who are manifesting as my physical body, as my bone structure, as sensation. And the moment I started thinking of the sensation as being mediated by a goddess, the sensation of the pain began to morph. And it was, pulsing, and it was kind of hot, like inflammation is physically hot. But I began to feel that it wanted to undulate inside my lower back, and it wanted to move my lower back. And I began to just enter into this kind of subtle, moving, physical dance without the feeling that I was doing it, more the feeling that I was being moved from inside. And I remembered something that one of the more radical female tantric teachers I know, Sophia Diaz, she often says that the difference between the ah and the ow, between the delightful sensation and the uncomfortable sensation, is the name you give it, because every sensation is a little goddess dancing. Every moment of your life can be a reminder to worship, to revere, to honor this amazing miracle that has given you a body and put you in touch with the innate eros that's constantly being enacted. And this is a crazy effective way to hack your life. you know, is just to keep reminding yourself that it's all being manifested, whether you know it or not, or whether you like it or not, by these radically loving, blissful beings. And this, I believe, is why tantric practice actually opens us to miracles and magical experiences and realizations and everything that Wendy was asking about. Because the more you become open to the sentience and presence in your body and in your senses and in your chakras, the more you begin to realize that these interactions which calibrate our inner state can actually be transformed by bringing our attention to our experience with this willingness to see it as a manifestation of grace, even when it doesn't feel so good. So, and I won't mention Kundalini Shakti because our time is limited, but obviously all of this is tremendously connected to the way in which the active energy of Kundalini Shakti manifests through our physical and subtle bodies. So, I want to talk a little bit about desire. And we'll really end by taking a look at the way in which desire, which as we know is considered an enemy in conventional spirituality, how desire, which is, of course, a manifestation of goddess, how our desires and our sense practices can be used as doorways. So, as we've often practiced, if you understand this principle, you understand that at the root of any experience of pleasure or pain, if you can let go of the apparent trigger, the experience will become a doorway into bliss. And I'm always reminded of something that one of my teachers said. She was once asked, "What is God?" Somebody came up to her during a program and, you know, sort of sat face to face with her and said, "What is God?" And she answered by asking, "Have you ever been in love?" And the person said, "Yes." And my teacher said, "God is the purest part of that love," which I think is kind of a genius way of talking about God, because, and it applies to sensation as well, you know, that. So one of the deep truths that Abhinava Gupta talks about, and which is very much a part of the tantric understanding of physical life, is that all contacts, all sensory contacts, participate in the kamakala, which is the word that's used for the place where God and goddess make love to each other. So in other words, when the air touches your skin, the air is making love to you. We've been doing that meditation. When your eyes experience a flower or the walls of your room or the mess on your desk, you're actually in a sensual contact. Your eyes and the objects of your sight are literally merging with each other, and we could say that they're making love to each other. So any experience that you have can become this expression of the lovemaking of God and goddess. So I'm going to give you this as a homework assignment. And it's a classical Vijnana Bhairava practice. It comes from a group of verses in the Vijnana Bhairava, which ask you to examine a sensory experience, which is, and the experiences that they talk about are hearing music, hearing sound, tasting food, sex, fragrance. In other words, they give you instructions for turning your sensual experience back to the self. And we're going to do it now using a practice which many of you have done with me in the past and which I find to be one of the most really effective and easily accessible ways that the Vijnana Bhairava teaches us to approach Goddess through the senses. And I just want to say, even if you've done this practice before, let yourself enter it, fully do it. So take a comfortable posture. It's always good when we're doing a practice like this to honor the practice by placing our body in a receptive position. And remember a moment of great satisfaction. And the text says, remember the joy of seeing a friend after a long time, or the first glimpse of your beloved after a long separation. So it's talking about relational satisfaction, but I would expand it. For instance, remember the moment when you've completed a project and it's gone well. You know, as a teacher, I have these moments of satisfaction when a class has really rocked. It makes me really happy, and that satisfaction lasts for hours sometimes. So get yourself into an experience of satisfaction. Perhaps it's a moment with your guru. If you have a guru, perhaps it's a moment with your child or your girlfriend or your boyfriend or an old boyfriend or girlfriend. And just take yourself back to that moment. This is a practice we do in memory. How does it feel to be satisfied, joyful? And notice where in your body that experience of satisfaction is felt. I know that, you know, that there might be resistances or it might not feel completely present right this moment, but you're going to have at least a partial memory. And now remove the trigger and stay with the feeling. And draw that feeling into the heart. Relaxing your shoulders and your face. And letting yourself nestle into the heart with a feeling of satisfaction. And this, as many of you know, is something you can do with anything you enjoy. You do it by really finding the felt experience of enjoyment and turning your attention away from the thing that's triggered it and away from whatever emotions of grasping you may be feeling, because wanting a good experience to last is one of the first things that our mind does. So turning your mind away from that, just feeling the satisfaction, perhaps offering it into the heart, perhaps thanking Goddess for manifesting as joy, perhaps spreading the feeling of joy through your body, or offering it, asking that all beings experience joy. You know, there's so many ways you can practice with this. But mostly, just letting yourself feel it. So, desire. Lalita is desire. She has several of her names describe her as desire. Kameshwari, Kameshi. She is praised again and again as the one who excites desire in Shiva, who, as we know, is a very balanced being. So part of the intent of describing her as the one who incites desire in Shiva is to complement her beauty and attractiveness. So desire, in a sense, is the goddess's primary superpower. It's the quality in her which is created, which causes all forms of creation to happen. And in the Shiva Sutras, there's the third sutra says, Icha Shakti Uma Kumare, which means the power of desire is the goddess. So there's a fairly obvious equation in the tantric text between desire and Lalita. And it's also true that since that period in history that Carl Jaspers called the Axial Age, between 800 BCE and 300 BCE, there was this flowering of the great religions, Buddhism and Confucianism and Judaism and other Zoroastrianism. And every one of these traditions basically taught that desire is the root of suffering. Craving is the root of suffering, Buddha said. And of course, when Arjuna asks Krishna, the Bhagavad Gita also is seems to be a product of this era. When Arjuna asks Krishna why people sin, Krishna, of course, says very famously, it is desire and anger, the dreaded enemies of the wise, that cause sin. Therefore, if you want to be a yogi, conquer desire. And, you know, we all have a zillion examples of why that's the case, because desire is Maya, you know. Desire is the goddess's, one of the goddess's main powers through which she creates the great world illusion. And all the yogic literature, of course, is full of stories about great yogis who fall prey to desire, especially sexual desire, and lose their yogic mojo and their stature. And now we have the Me Too movement, which is essentially a moment of reckoning for powerful men who believe that they can act out sexual desire with less powerful people using them as objects. So samsara itself, the round of rebirth, and most of our good and bad karmas are caused by desire, which of course constantly replenish themselves because one desire leads to the next. You know, you can't just have a slice of pizza, you also need a Coke. And then you need to get some exercise because your belly is distended and on and on and on. So actually, I used the word need. It actually the proper word is want. But of course, the problem with desire is that the things we desire are not satisfying, and so we're because external objects of satisfaction do not permanently satisfy us. I mean, you might have wanted money very badly and gone out of your way to create abundance for yourself. And at a certain point, you realize, oh, this isn't making me happy, even though I'm happier having some money than I would be if I didn't have any. But nonetheless, the feeling that I had that if I could satisfy this desire, everything would be okay, turns out not to be true. So for this reason, renunciation, vairagya, renunciation of desires, is regarded as an indispensable prerequisite for successful practice. So Tantra seemingly reverses the ordinary position on desire and sees it in a much more subtle fashion as, first of all, as the engine of the goddess's power. So part of what Tantra tells us is that when you have a strong desire, when you're willing to put your energy into fulfilling a desire, it will inevitably be fulfilled. Unfortunately, it may not be fulfilled in the time frame that you would prefer. So, this is what all the traditions tell you. You might end up 15 years from now suddenly wondering why it is that, that you're, let's say, the woman you were in love with when you were 20 is suddenly on the phone calling you when now you're happily married or just not interested in her, because that desire, that wish has borne fruit. So what most people who really contemplate the nature of desire have come to realize is twofold. And what I'm going to say here is based on something I learned from a book by the Buddhist psychologist Mark Epstein. I want to credit him because I think he really articulated this very well. First of all, and I'm gonna take this. This isn't Mark, this is me. But so part of what the tantric understanding shows us is that our desires are not our fault. We're not responsible for our desires or for our anger or for our emotions. I mean, we are responsible for how we enact them. We're responsible for how we work with them. But we're not responsible for the fact that they arise, because remember, Goddess is making everything arise on the inside and on the outside. And one of the things that Epstein points out is that that in rigid societies, like, for instance, the society that Freud practiced in his early years, or in the religious communities of India and actually all over the world, the fear of our own desires and the secrecy around that we feel we have to maintain around the fact that some of our desires are not for public announcement is actually one of the major obstructions in our lives. We're ashamed of our desires. But if you realize that your desires are not coming from your character flaws or even from you in your most positive way, it's actually coming from Goddess. It's not what Freud said, of course. Freud said it comes from the unconscious. But if you really look into your own unconscious, you realize that your unconscious is a much more direct manifestation of Goddess than your conscious mind. One of the great American Jungian psychologists, James Hillman, said, and here I'm quoting from Epstein, "Most theoretical models hold that rages, fears, and passions are our personal responsibility, that somehow, somewhere, they're located inside us. My contention here is that though they be felt deeply and we suffer emotions physically and inwardly, this fact does not make them ours. Rather, I believe that emotions are there to make us theirs. They want to possess us, rule us, win us over completely to their vision. So, in other words, what he's pointing to is the fact that our emotions, which, remember, come from Goddess, they're expressions of Goddess. Our emotions want to take us over. They want to make us into their image. And we need to not be fooled by them. So whether we try to repress emotion or whether we let ourselves act on it, we lose our capacity for actually enjoying the wonder of the way in which our life experience is constantly showing up in new and unusual ways. What is the agenda of desire in the goddess's play? It's twofold. Lalita, as Kameshwari, uses her capacity for desiring to make a world that she manages to make look as though it's outside her, when in fact it's inside her. And for us as inhabitants of this world, our desires, which, remember, are given and orchestrated by the goddesses, by the yoginis, by the senses and the mind-born forms, our normal desires keep us seeking and therefore creating karmic situations which we then have to enact. And to use the language of Indian philosophy, keep us bound to the wheel of samsara. So the question that comes up when a desire arises is to question not how to get what we desire or what we do to desire, but what does desire really want from us? What does it want to show us? And as spiritual people, one of the things that our desires probably want to show us is that there's a need for satisfaction that we need to pay attention to. And that need for satisfaction may show up as loneliness, it may show up as craving, but behind it is always the longing for fullness, for rest, really the longing for goddess. You know, that if we can say that goddess creates desire in us as a way of bringing us close to her, and we, of course, get bamboozled and think that the desire is for something else, but really the desire is for her. And so that's one of the principles of tantric desire, is to keep realizing, to keep questioning our desires, to keep asking ourselves, what do you want by getting what you want? And really paying attention to the answers that come up, because I believe I gave you this exercise the first week. It's worth really making a part of your self-inquiry whenever a desire comes up. What do I want by getting what I want? What do I want by, for instance, wanting to express myself in this particular way or have a relationship with this particular person or eat this particular food? Assuming that the desire we're talking about is not, you know, a basic human need, such as eating when we're hungry or sleeping when we're sleepy, normally what's behind the desire is a desire for closeness to our own erotic source. You know, what we desire is Eros herself, that is, goddess herself. So the other way of looking at desire that is to simply see it as divine. And to realize that especially when our desires involve relationship, you know, when our desires are for closeness to another or for interaction with another, that what we're desiring is a kind of communion that will more deeply help us recognize the divine nature that we share, the pure consciousness and love that is communicated between people and between people and animals and between all living beings when we allow ourselves to be fully present with them. And I want to read you a prayer from the Jewish tradition. It's called the Shema. And again, I'm quoting from Epstein. I'm sort of going back and forth between what the people he's quoting and the tantric perspective that we're working with here. So those of you who are familiar with the Hebrew wisdom tradition will recognize this prayer. It's quite famous. I'm not going to say it in Hebrew, of course. But this verse plays on the famous incident of Moses on Mount Sinai. And it explains how Moses is instructed to turn desire from something that keeps him away from God to something that reminds him of God's blessings. So it's a way of pointing out that when we let go of our ego-based desire for gratification, our feeling that fulfilling a desire is for me, into a willingness to recognize that what we want is for the sake of a deeper communion with our divine self. Here's how it goes. God said to Moses, "Let Israel throughout her generations make tzitzit," which means fringe, those fringes, the ritual fringes that Orthodox Jewish men wear, "fringes with a thread of blue on the corners of her garments to look at and remember all the blessings of God and to do them. Otherwise, all of you will follow only what your eyes see and your hearts desire, forgetting that everything you see and whatever you desire are signs of my presence in the world. But looking at the knotted fringes, you'll remember as a knot around the finger that everything you see and whatever you desire can be seen and done as one of my mitzvot, one of my blessings. Thus will you share the holiness of God, who saw you as slaves in Egypt and desired you to become a people of God." Now, I guess this is a true expression of goddess, because it's making me weep, which is one of the signs that goddess is present. So the understanding that your desires are there to show you goddess, that whatever you desire is a desire for goddess, is probably at the heart of the tantric realization. And at the heart of tantric ritual, just as Orthodox Jews tie fringes to the corners of their vests and clothes to remind themselves of God's presence, in the same way, in Tantra, rituals are enacted, worship is enacted, mantras and prayers are enacted, at least in part as a way of assimilating the physical universe into the heart, so that goddess can enjoy it and so that we can communicate with goddess through our activities, our rituals, and our desires. So let's sit for a moment as we come to a close, as we bring our class to a close, and contemplate your strongest desire in this moment. Whatever it is, which it may be something very simple like wanting to satisfy your hunger or wanting the class to be over because your office is calling or whatever it may be, or a big desire or a longing for truly profound spiritual experience. let yourself feel the energy of desire, whether it's as restlessness, as affection, as grasping, or simply as arousal, as charge, as excitement. And then breathe that feeling of desire into the heart. And feel that Goddess Lalita, the beautiful one of the three worlds, seated inside your body, is receiving your desire and loving you for desiring. Because desire is her very nature. So have a wonderful week, and you'll receive a homework assignment and, of course, the MP3 of this class. Thank you so much for being part of this community, and thank you so much for your practice, your love, and the connections that we share. Have a beautiful evening. Namaste.